Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 215. It's Monday, June 12th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, the wildfires in Canada last week was really a rude awakening for the eastern half of the United States. Of a new norm, perhaps, in the future with climate change, a burning world, a world literally on fire. Of course, it was more than just the eastern United States, though that smoke reached Mexico and even Norway. So the entire world is affected by wildfires burning around the planet. So let's clear this up from a public health perspective. The smoke that we breathe is not good for anybody. This from MedPage Today. Even healthy people should minimize exposure to wildfire smoke, experts say. Generally, if you can avoid being outside, that's what we recommend. Samir Canijo, a pulmonologist with Northwell Health in Manhasset, New York, said, walking to the car to get to work, things like that we have to do. But going outside, biking, playing ball, swimming in the pool, you should try to avoid until the air quality gets a bit better. He noted that children, the elderly, people with underlying medical conditions, particularly respiratory and cardiac conditions, are most at risk with wildfire smoke inhalation. Those with respiratory diseases such as asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease can experience exacerbations, he said. Peter DiCarlo, an associate professor of environmental health and engineering at Johns Hopkins School of Engineering in Baltimore, agreed that, quote, everyone is at risk from air pollution, and that children, the elderly, and those with chronic conditions are particularly vulnerable. We associate respiratory conditions with air quality problems, but the reality is that it impacts our hearts and our brains and other body systems, DiCarlo said. Those chemicals that we breathe in will deposit in our lungs, and then from our lungs via our blood, travel to all other parts of the body. He and Canijo recommended wearing a mask, mainly a well-fitting K95 or N95, when going outside in such smoke. And of course, we're not all equally exposed to the smoke. Some people have a harder time avoiding it. This from the Washington Post. Outdoor workers endure wildfire smoke, hazardous air quality. From dog walkers to delivery drivers, from landscapers to farm laborers, many workers whose jobs require time in the outdoors have plowed on this week, even as smoke from wildfires ranging in Canada have created an abysmal air quality up and down the East Coast. Their predicament reveals how outdoor laborers, more than any other segment of the workforce, remain vulnerable when it comes to climate change. Across the globe, these men and women are more likely to fall ill and die of exposure to extreme heat, which can be intensified by rising humidity. From construction workers in Nepal to sugarcane harvesters in El Salvador to landscapers in Las Vegas and moped drivers in India, laboring outside poses major health risks. Workers can become overheated, suffer long-term damage to their kidneys, or breathe in unhealthy air that can cause major respiratory illness. In the United States, as code red and code purple alerts have proliferated along areas that are home to tens of millions of Americans, some workplaces have taken steps to limit the exposure to their employees to polluted air. Major League Baseball postponed multiple games. A restaurant owner in Philadelphia shut down outdoor dining at some locations to keep staff out of harm's way. The city of Allentown, Pennsylvania sent parks and recreation workers home. Amtrak was among numerous companies that made masks available to workers who wanted them. and said it would delay non-critical work in areas deemed hazardous. If it is feasible, I would encourage not working outside, said Panagis Galiasatos, a pulmonary medical physician at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and a spokesman for the American Lung Association. But he also knows that for many people in the path of wildfire smoke, that option simply isn't a reality. If people have to work outdoors, by all means take the proper precautions to stay safe, he said. That includes wearing a high-quality, tight-fitting mask outdoors, staying hydrated, and putting off any jobs that can wait a couple of days. People who drive a lot for work could make sure that their air conditioner circulates only the inside air. So put it on recirc. Data show that millions of Americans rely on time outside as part of their livelihood. As of 2020, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 4.3% of civilian workers are required to spend more than two-thirds of their workday outdoors, including landscaping crews, construction laborers, and highway maintenance workers. Another 15% were required to be outdoors as much as a third of their workday, including preschool teachers, truck drivers, carpenters, and reporters. As climate change fuels more intense wildfires, stronger storms, and more crippling heat waves, scientists have warned that outdoor workers around the globe will likely face more challenging conditions more often. But many governments have resisted taking action, as businesses have fought stricter standards that can make it more expensive to operate. The warming planet is making hot areas even hotter and drastically reducing the time people can spend outside, which means some outdoor workers cannot work the required hours and thus will earn less, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change wrote in their sprawling report last year. Okay, well, next up I wanted to share some of the commentary from your local epidemiologist on Substack, Wildfire Smoke, COVID-19, and Striking Comparisons. And she notes three things that seem to drive this. First, visible versus invisible threats. When something is invisible, it's much more difficult to act. This has long been a menace to public health. Would masking during winter be different if viruses created green plumes of smoke? Tools that make viruses as visible as smoke, like perhaps a viral load detector on weather apps, could be low-hanging fruit. Secondly, immediate versus delayed effect. Symptoms from smoke are pretty immediate, such as watery eyes and coughing. Symptoms from viruses are delayed, take a few days to replicate in your body. And in some cases, immune system will prevent infection or symptoms altogether, so the causal relationship is less apparent to people. Thirdly, novel versus familiar threat. COVID-19 is not novel anymore. The majority of people have become more comfortable placing its risk among our normal repertoire of threats. Wildfire smoke in the Northeast is novel. Would the same number of people be wearing a mask after 3.5 years of wildfire smoke? Risk communication is key. Clear, timely risk communication is important so people can make evidence-based decisions today. We did this terribly during the pandemic. It was better with smoke. With a novel threat like wildfire smoke, it's best to compare to harms that we know, like cigarettes. This helps gauge risk more accurately. So there's a little chart here that I include and that I'll share that relevant data with you, and it's how does air quality correspond to smoking cigarettes? So you may have become familiar in the last week with the different air quality color codes, green being the lowest and good and healthy, then moving up the various risks from yellow to orange to red to purple and to maroon. Okay, well, when you look at these colored risk codes, the air quality index, they've matched it up with the corresponding amount of cigarettes smoked if you were outside the whole day. So yellow, which is not uncommon, frankly, the norm, certainly in summertime in Ohio, that's like smoking one cigarette a day. Orange is like smoking two cigarettes. Red is like smoking five cigarettes. Purple is like smoking nine cigarettes. And maroon is smoking like 11 cigarettes. And the peak that was in New York City, the worst, the epicenter of all that smoke, if you were outside the whole day, it was like smoking 37 cigarettes. That's like two packs of cigarettes. Yikes. Well, I've put some more stories in the bonus story section at the end of the show. I'll give links online and give you a brief synopsis of those stories that about how we can protect ourselves in the future, as this appears to be something that's going to be happening more and more often. And by the way, the fire season has just begun in Canada. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears a bit and talk about the basic social determinants in health and remind people that Ohio ranked 50th in family resiliency. Oh, that means our families are basically under siege and poorly equipped to deal with any kind of crisis, anything out of the normal. In fact, even normality is a crisis for many families. But I want to talk about some changes, or actually the proposed budget of the Ohio State Senate. This is from Advocates for Ohio's Future. And this gets to the fact that families in particular are under siege. So this Ohio State Senate proposes to institute an asset test for SNAP eligibility, limiting most households' assets to $2,250. The same provision was defeated in the 2021 budget and would force SNAP participants to choose between having a car and a home and food assistance. Requiring SNAP participants aged 16 to 59 to participate in Ohio's mandatory employment and training program, up from the 18 to 49 age range, so adding 10 years. This would make Ohio's program the most restrictive in the nation. Underfunds Ohio food banks funding at a time of unprecedented need for food support. Cuts the House added provision to make reduced price school meals free to low-income students. I reported how that is a big winner for everybody. Very cost-effective and a great public health program. Cuts House added Medicaid coverage for pregnant women and children under age 19 with incomes up to 300% of the federal poverty line. Cuts House added continuous Medicaid enrollment for Medicaid-eligible children from birth through age 3. That's another kind of movement to try to expand that, similar to what we had in the pandemic where people couldn't thrown off. It makes a lot of sense for young children to, rather than have them go on and off Medicaid because of all the bureaucracy, is just enroll them when they're eligible, if they're eligible as a young child, and just keep them up through like 3 or 4 or 5 years. The Ohio Senate wants to cut the House added 5-year pilot program in Medicare to cover birthing doula services. Require Ohio Medicaid to implement additional Medicaid enrollment requirements and administrative barriers. Yeah, why don't we make the red tape worse? Cuts proposed publicly funded child care eligibility increase from 160% of the poverty line down to 145% of the poverty line. Cuts healthy aging grants to local partners that would help older adults stay in their homes, stay connected in their communities, and promote healthy and active lifestyles. Slashes funding for healthy beginnings at home by more than 80%, a program to provide rental assistance and housing stabilization services to pregnant women with unstable housing and at greater risk of infant mortality. So much for pro-life. Cuts the new $500 million affordable housing tax credit program. Makes private school tuition vouchers universal regardless of wealth and decreases K-12 public school funding by $540 million per year. So this is the example of like you're cutting all the programs for the most vulnerable and then you have no income requirements for a huge program, which is funding of schools. And lastly, but not least, eliminates personal income tax brackets. So every income group that's taxed is taxed at the same rate, which would cause a $1 billion loss in tax revenues each fiscal year. And you might note that that benefits the most wealthy the most. Okay, well, next up, I want to get back to something that deals with air quality, and it's something that we've learned from COVID, but it can move forward. All the wildfire smoke and such is kind of re-upped that as a public health concern. But some good news as far as COVID is that U.S. COVID hospitalizations and deaths have reached a record low. And I want to announce that I am actually satisfied with the death levels of COVID. Now, obviously, any death is tragic, But COVID's not going to go away, so you're going to have baselines. But the levels have reached down well under. I was hoping to get under 100 or 200 a day, but actually we're well below that right now. So that is very good news. Now, the hospitalizations haven't gone down as much as deaths have. And that's partly because the new bivalent booster shots have only been taken by only about less than 1 out of 5 people that are eligible for it. And that booster actually helps prevent hospitalization. But the basic immunity that we have across the population is pretty good at keeping you alive. It just might not keep you out of the hospital. Okay, but that is not the case all around the world. Back in China, COVID is ramping up. What about China's new COVID wave? This from Time. When a Chinese senior health advisor projected 65 million COVID-19 cases per week in China by June, some health experts sounded the alarm. China's been facing a new COVID wave fueled by the XBB variant since April. Data from Zhang Nanxin, a respiratory disease doctor who was among the first to confirm COVID-19's easily transmissibility, provided a rare insight to how the disease could possibly be spreading in China almost 6 months after Beijing abruptly ended its draconian zero COVID strategy. Since pivoting to, quote, living with the virus policy from early December, the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention stopped updating weekly infections. But the sudden relaxation of anti-epidemic protocols also led to an estimated 37 million new infections a day, only weeks later. By January, experts said they believe almost 80% of China's 1.4 billion people had already been infected in this first wave. For the second wave since April, Zhang's modeling revealed that the XBB variant is expected to cause 40 million infections weekly by May and going up to 65 million in June. This goes against the grain of Chinese health officials' estimates that the wave had peaked in April. And just as a postscript on that, we have not gotten good death data from China from the first wave. So China and their transparency is something that's very much lacking. But China is still in the mix of it. And their vaccination quality was a lot lower. And they've got one round of 80% of the people being infected. So you got that dose of, you know, immunity that's built up. But this XBB variant is very good at cutting through and causing infection. So hopefully we'll find more data about the first wave as far as deaths and the second. And hopefully the second's a lot less than the first. Okay, well, I want to back up from that and do a story from the New York Times that gets at asking a very basic question. What if there was never a pandemic again? And this basically means from respiratory viruses such as the coronavirus. And this gives a very good historical timeline and perspective of the role of public health in eliminating a lot of major killers. And then, of course, we take them for granted after that. This from the New York Times. What if there was never a pandemic again? Modern humans have existed for over 200,000 years. A mere 500 years ago, daily life was strewn with infectious risk. Eating a meal was a risk, as was drinking a glass of water. As we shifted to indoor city life, outbreaks and pandemics whipped through society with alarming regularity. At one point, major epidemics of plague were occurring approximately every 30 years in England, killing about one-fifth or more of London's population each time. The black golf ball-sized pus-filled buboes caused by the culprit bacteria Yersinia pestis so terrified Queen Elizabeth I that she escaped the city of Windsor and her court and ordered anyone who followed her to be executed. Throughout the 1800s, pandemics of cholera occurred around every decade or two. In the last 100 years of its existence, smallpox outbreaks are estimated to have killed 500 million people. As recently as a century ago, experts predicted that it would not be possible to sustain human cities and populations in the millions for long because of the inevitable spread of disease. But technological changes have allowed us, in the developed world at least, to prevent many such pandemics. Vaccines and drugs are not the only innovations we've relied on for this kind of prevention. We no longer view soap, toilet flushing, or clean tap water as the revolutionary disease prevention technologies they truly are. In the developed world, they are cheap, ubiquitous, and mundane. Yet these technologies fight a whole host of outbreaks without our needing to know each pathogen's name. Epidemics like cholera still occur in the developing world, but this is a matter of a lack of global political will, not a lack of technological way. The next generation pandemic prevention technologies are on our doorstep. and building these tools into our environment could make COVID-19 the world's last pandemic. But to realize this future, we need to commit to viewing pandemic prevention as just as much of a political priority as pandemic response has been. The COVID-19 pandemic exploited a narrow gap in humanity's outbreak prevention barriers. As the world now knows, SARS-CoV-2 spreads through the air via respiratory transmission. Spread can even occur before people develop symptoms. Our modern, mostly indoor lifestyles constructed the optimal environment for a fast-moving respiratory pandemic. Clean water, clean hands, clean food, and clean services did not stop the virus from hitching a ride on airplanes or spreading at packed concert bars and restaurants. As in the past, we need to develop technology that will fundamentally change our environment. In the United States, all modern buildings are built with fire prevention in mind, despite the last city burning fire occurring over a generation ago. We provided piped water and sewer systems, electricity to boil water and refrigerate food, and window screens to stop pests. The goal today should be to take respiratory pandemics entirely off the table. This starts with cleaning the air. The most ambitious version of clean indoor air technology would be capable of rapidly suppressing transmission for even the most contagious pathogens, like measles, at a cost affordable enough to install in all the places people gather and cross paths. Accomplishing this will require innovation beyond better ventilation and ways to filter air. This could include light bulbs that also emit germ-killing wavelengths that are still safe for humans. With this type of innovation, society can reduce transmission and maybe even make the common cold a relic. The Biden administration has declared improving ventilation a priority, but simply upgrading out-of-date filtration systems to the current standard probably won't be enough to prevent pandemics. Researchers have made progress toward other advanced pandemic fighting capabilities. It is now possible to take any type of sample from a possibly infected person and sequence the genome of every microorganism in that sample, bacteria, viruses, fungi, and all. All pathogens have genomic material, and sequencing allows us to read that material. This method, metagenomic sequencing, functions as a universal pathogen detector. It is beginning to be used to monitor patients for known pathogens, as well as bugs we have never seen before. Vaccines, of course, a mainstay of prevention, and even these have been incredible improvements with the advent of mRNA vaccines. Work is ongoing to deliver pandemic vaccines within 100 days. Efforts towards making vaccines effective against entire groups of viruses, such as all coronaviruses, are underway. But for modern vaccines to truly prevent rapid respiratory pandemics, they must be deployed widely and quickly, and when possible, in advance. The U.S. government is investing in microneedle vaccine packages and nasal spray vaccines that can be self-administered. These could be quickly mailed to every household, eliminating the need for clinic and pharmacy-based administration by trained healthcare workers. Scientists think that skin patches and nasal vaccines may be able to elicit mucosal immunity, something current injectable vaccines don't do very well. Mucosal immunity prevents viruses that land on our mucous membranes in the nose, mouth, and lungs from causing infection entirely. Preventing pandemics, full stop, will be a uniquely difficult and ambitious challenge for the 21st century. But based on history, it is both achievable and worth aiming for. We have never had more momentum against the scourge of infectious disease than we do today. There are more people across the planet engaged in the development and deployment of technologies against pandemics now than during any other time in human history. These recent advances, accelerated by the COVID pandemic, are reaching an inflection point. By investing in transformative technologies now, as public health has done for generations, we may be able to make COVID-19 the last pandemic. So just as a reminder, you know, if you look in history, you don't have to go too far back. If you look in the 1920s and 30s, less than a century ago, most of the top 10 leading causes of death were infectious disease. That was before we had widespread sanitation and the other methods that were outlined in this article that became widespread and just normal in the background that protected us. And of course, with all the division and misinformation with the COVID pandemic, it accents all the more importance that we do structural built environment changes that can protect us, that don't require each individual to be convinced to take personal behavior that will protect one another. So, air quality. That's the story for today and perhaps this century. Okay, well, let's move to some healthcare stories. And perhaps as usual, this is a case study in how our healthcare system is shot full of holes. First up from CNN, more kids are anxious, but fewer get the right help, study shows. More kids, teens, and young adults are experiencing anxiety, but fewer are getting the appropriate treatment, according to the latest research. A new study looked at data from the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey from 2006 to 2018 and assessed office-based physician visits to see how many included an anxiety disorder diagnosis and what treatment, if any, was given. The patients observed range in age from 4 to 24 years old. While visits for anxiety increased from 1.4% of all visits in 2006 to 2009 period to 4.2% in the period from 2014 to 2018, the proportion of visits with therapy decreased, according to the study published in the American Academy of Pediatrics journal Pediatrics. The likelihood of a patient receiving medication alone to treat the anxiety with no therapy increased significantly in the later years of the data analyzed. The data around treatment is troubling because existing evidence has shown that for most people, therapy is the best way to treat anxiety. But the bulk of young people were not receiving any kind of therapy, even though treatment like cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is a frontline defense against anxiety. For severe conditions that do benefit from medication, best practices say those patients should have both pharmaceutical and psychotherapy interventions. Taking medication as the only form of treatment could mean being on it for a long time. The fact that they're not receiving therapy suggests they're basically not learning tools to cope with anxiety on their own, adding that especially concerning for young people who are still developing biologically and socially. Living with conditions such as anxiety and depression can feel like being in an ocean, said Dr. Ariana Howitt, Executive Clinical Director of On Our Sleeves, an initiative created by Nationwide Children's Hospital that advocates for children's mental health. Howitt was not involved in the research. Therapy is meant to teach you to swim, but sometimes you are sinking from exhaustion from navigating the currents and need floats to help, she added. That's what the medication can be, Howitt said. You can have these floaties and it gives you that breather. It takes away the intensity of the symptoms, but then you still want to go into therapy to learn the tools to still learn how to cope with it and live with it and live through it. We would hope that patients can have access to both, and then we wouldn't see the sort of changes over time that we're observing where actually more patients are receiving medications only, she added. Well, that's our drug-obsessed culture and medical care system. Next up from Medical Express, more than 3 in 5 children do not receive timely mental health services after firearm injury. More than 3 in 5 children, 63%, enrolled in Medicaid do not receive mental health services within 6 months after a firearm injury, according to a new study published in the journal Pediatrics. In the United States, 11,258 youth experienced non-fatal firearm injuries in 2020. Children who survive firearm injuries are at increased risk for adverse mental health outcomes, such as a newly diagnosed trauma-related disorder, substance use, and disruptive disorders. In addition to these disorders, the study found that after injury, the percentage of children diagnosed with bipolar, schizophrenia spectrum disorders, and suicidal ideation or self-injury nearly doubled. In our study, we found that while too many children did not receive mental health care follow-up, children with new mental health diagnoses identified during the firearm injury encounter had over twice the odds of a timely connection to outpatient mental health care, said lead author Jennifer Hoffman, emergency medicine physician at the Children's Hospital of Chicago. This shows that after a firearm injury, mental health screening and referral for youth at high risk are essential, as well as required by the 2022 American College of Surgeons standards for pediatric trauma centers. The best practice still needs wider implementation. The study also detects inequalities in mental health care access after firearm injury, with Black youth less likely to have any mental health follow-up than white youth. Mechanisms underlying these inequities may include stigma and costs related to accessing care, limited diversity in the mental health workforce, and shortages of mental health professionals in areas where Black children live, said Dr. Hoffman. Attention is needed to address barriers at the individual, health system, and societal levels that may prevent Black youth from accessing mental health services. For children without prior mental health service, greater efforts are needed to connect them to mental health providers. To improve outcomes, it is important to prioritize early detection of mental health needs, equitable access to mental health care, and timeliness of care.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, I'd like to pan out a little bit more from a bird's eye view and look how our research into health problems actually has disparities that don't match the actual problems in the population. This from Medical Express. Study identifies marked disparities in federal cancer research funding. A research team at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Miami School of Medicine compiled and analyzed statistics from federal cancer research funding sources and found that funds tend to be allocated more heavily towards cancers that occur more often in non-Hispanic white people than in other racial and ethnic groups. The study found that funding across cancer sites is not proportional with lethality, and that cancers with high incidence among racial ethnic minorities receive lower funding. But the study authors say addressing these inequities could make a difference in cancer research disparities within a short time. Breast cancer research received approximately 50 times more funding than stomach cancer in 2018, even though estimated breast cancer deaths were only 4 times those of stomach cancer deaths. Wow, that's over a tenfold difference. The authors also cited previously published statistics showing that cancer is more frequently affecting non-Hispanic white people, such as breast cancer, leukemia, and lymphoma, receive more funding than cancers with high incidence rates among racial ethnic minorities, such as stomach, uterine, and liver cancers. A reality challenging that all lives matter equally. And next up from patient engagement, even at top hospitals, racial health disparities in patient safety are steep. Even the highest performing hospitals see racial health disparities in adverse patient safety events, with a new report from the LeapFrog Group and the Urban Institute showing that gaps persist across top and bottom rated hospitals. Although patient safety was generally higher for all racial groups in the top rated hospitals, disparities persisted. Regardless of hospital rating, white patients were less likely to experience an adverse patient safety event than their black and Hispanic peers. For example, black patients were more likely to experience the surgery-related complications that the researchers examined. Particularly, they faced a 34% higher rate of sepsis after surgery, 51% higher rates of dangerous blood clots after surgery, and 17% higher rates of respiratory failure after surgery. Further, black patients had a higher risk of stage 3 and 4 pressure ulcers, or bed sores, that have progressed to becoming debilitating or deadly. The researchers also looked at patient safety disparities across payer types, noting that patients with private insurance were less likely to experience an adverse patient safety event compared to those with Medicare or Medicaid. This was consistent across all hospitals, regardless of safety rating. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, I wanted to cover a story that gets at the rather obvious fact that we need to do smarter healthcare spending. We get the worst value for our dollar in healthcare of all the so-called industrialized countries. But some of those solutions, you know, fit well within the healthcare system. But ones that start to get towards social determinants, I would argue, are probably very, very poorly implemented by this very inefficient system that's not geared towards prevention. But here we go. This from The Hill. America's healthcare paradox. We need smarter spending, not more. It's an old American story. We pay more for healthcare than any other country on the planet, yet outcomes lag those of other developed nations. This embarrassing fact keeps us obsessed with cutting healthcare costs, presumably so that lower costs better reflect the lower value of our healthcare investment. But there's another way to achieve value, and that is by changing how we spend our $4.3 trillion in annual health expenditures. Other developed countries have figured this out, and new data compiled by the Kaiser Family Foundation Peterson Health System Tracker provide a timely reminder of the urgency to change our spending patterns by investing in non-medical drivers or social determinants of health. Compared to spending patterns for the same countries based on earlier data, the new data show that from 2011 to 2019, although the U.S. increased its investment in social spending, it continued to overinvest in health compared to social spending, while comparable countries continue to do the opposite. And over the same period of time, U.S. health outcomes continued to fall behind those of comparable countries, and in some cases, the gap grew larger. The Innovation Center has deployed more than 20 models that incorporate non-medical drivers into the healthcare delivery system. The growth of popularity of Medicare Advantage plans is due in part to the inclusion of non-medical benefits such as carpet cleaning for asthmatics and nutrition and exercise programs for diabetics. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is approving Medicaid waivers with significant investments in non-medical drivers, such as food and housing, and encouraging states to use, in lieu of services, authorities to support non-medical investments. Hospitals are increasingly being urged to invest in improving community health outcomes. So, of course, social determinants is the name of the game for getting value for your buck. Again, I just question whether our healthcare system should disproportionately be the leader of that. Obviously, the healthcare system is 20% of our economy and should be a center of healing and health. But I don't know if hospitals should be designing our food systems or, you know, being the major funders for housing and such. They can play their role, but I'm not sure it should be an outsized role. It's a little bit like the tail wagging the dog. And I actually see this conundrum has some parallels with what we see with trying to produce safety in our communities and looking through law enforcement as the way to do that. And particularly those that parallel becomes very, very easy to see when you look at mental health. Law enforcement does not interface with mental health problems very well and has a good reputation for making things even worse. So I would argue that there's a parallel type of thing that law enforcement should stick to the more narrow scope of law enforcement and allow the other aspects of society to deal with, for instance, mental health problems. And I would say the same thing with social determinants. I'm glad that they're thinking more prevention, but since they're not actually doing prevention very well, maybe we should center that around those agencies and programs that are more prevention oriented, looking at social determinants as their primary way of functioning. That would be public health in its many forms. And when you're talking about the huge amounts of money that are spent on healthcare, the amount that's spent on public health is mere pennies on the dollar compared to healthcare. So shifting the, you know, since 50% basically of the healthcare dollar that we spend is not bringing us value compared to other countries, what if we threw a nickel or a dime per dollar towards actually health, public health rather than simple medical care or sick care? Okay, well, next up, I want to cover a story that really gets at why our healthcare system is not really a system, and we are very far from kind of a unified national health program. This from Stat News. Your health insurance may not be as good as your state requires, and it's perfectly legal. In 2017, the Massachusetts State Legislature passed a law to ensure ease of access to birth control. It says there should be no copay for hormonal birth control prescriptions. It allows women to fill a 12-month prescription at once. Infertility care has similar protections. The state mandates that plans cover, quote, medically necessary expenses of diagnosis and treatment of infertility if the insurance provides other pregnancy-related benefits. This includes comprehensive coverage of even costly treatments such as in vitro fertilization. However, health plans covering 57% of Massachusetts residents and a similar rate nationally don't have to comply with state laws like these. Why? Because many companies are, quote, self-insured. If you get your insurance through your job at a big company, there's a good chance that includes you. A health plan is self-insured if the company you work for collects the premiums and takes on the ultimate responsibility of paying employees and dependents' medical claims. A third party may actually manage those processes, however, so you might not even realize it. ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, set minimum standards of how retirement plans and other workplace benefits are administered. This law protects employees by, for example, requiring employers to provide plan information and establish grievance procedures. As far as ERISA is concerned, when a company self-insures, it isn't paying for a health insurance policy, it's providing an employee benefit, paying your medical bills. For patients, this is a distinction without a difference. But the upshot is that self-insured plans are not required to provide state-mandated healthcare benefits, only those required by federal law. It seems most people only learn about this oddity when it affects them. It's been the subject of a lot of jurisprudence all the way up to the Supreme Court, though it tends not to receive attention outside of specialized circles. It's also not easily fixed. Congress could amend ERISA, but that might just create new consequences. Not all large companies self-insure, but most, about 80% according to the Employee Benefit Research Institute, do. The way an employer chooses to finance its benefits should not prevent states from regulating healthcare to improve residents' lives. More clarity about healthcare rights in general would help too. Patients and providers alike often don't know what they are entitled to. In 2020, 3 years after the Access to Contraception law was passed, of the 1.2 million people eligible, only 300 obtained a 12-month supply of birth control. So across the country, when a state passes a health law, it doesn't apply to most people.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, next up, want to do an article, sort of the consequence of this very punishing hodgepodge that we call a healthcare system. This from Stat News, how the conversation about moral injury in healthcare is changing. Research, both published and preliminary, confirms our hypothesis that burnout and moral injury are distinct experiences, though they often co-occur. Moreover, they may influence each other. For example, short staffing is a type of demand-resource mismatch that can drive burnout. But when a repeated request to increase staffing to safe levels fails to elicit a response, clinicians may perceive that as a betrayal, increasing their risk for moral injury. And morally injurious situations that are inescapable may lead to the learned helplessness, cynicism, and detachment of burnout. Many challenge the need for a new language, arguing that we have a half century of research on burnout. Surely, they said, that must encapsulate this experience we identified. But clinicians' response said otherwise. In my practice as a psychiatrist, providing an accurate diagnosis often flooded patients with a profound sense of relief. They finally felt deeply understood and no longer alone, even if the diagnosis was uncomfortable. A diagnosis of attention deficit or bipolar disorder could help organize what they have long worried was simply a lack of discipline. They shed the blame of pejorative labels like lazy or unmotivated and had a clearer path to healing. That language changed how my patients thought about themselves and how others thought about them too. It is the same with the language of distress. One therapist told me that talking with clinician clients about moral injury let them shed the shame of individual responsibility for the system's dysfunction driving their, quote, burnout. Separating burnout from moral injury also could provide a useful approach to developing solutions. The demand resource mismatches of burnout, the operational drivers, are substantial and must be addressed. Clumsy electronic medical records, understaffing, and administrative overburden, among others. but it is equally essential to address the relational ruptures, the betrayal at the heart of moral injury, by recommitting to a just workplace, which encourages workers to speak up, a learning culture, and the restorative justice principles of accepting responsibility for harm, even if unintentional, self-reflection, introspection, and making amends. In our 2018 piece for STAT on moral injury, we wrote that the increasingly complex web of providers, highly conflicted allegiances to patients, to self, and to employers, and its attendant moral injury may be driving the healthcare ecosystem to a tipping point that has never been truer than it is today. Correctly identifying drivers in ways that resonate with the workforce and developing targeted solutions could be the answer to retaining and sustaining a robust healthcare workforce. Adding new language alongside an existing concept seems easy enough if it helps make such necessary change. So at Just for the Health of It, we try to put the just in Just for the Health of It. Okay, well, I want to end today's regular reporting with some better news. This from Axios. LGBT health coverage improved after the ACA and a Supreme Court marriage ruling. Health insurers responded to the 2015 Supreme Court decision recognizing same-sex marriage with more equitable coverage for LGBTQ couples, including spousal benefits, according to a new study published in Health Affairs. The percentage of all LGBTQ adults with a usual source of health care access increased from 64% in 2013 to 75% in 2019. By 2019, coverage rates for LGBTQ adults were comparable to those of non-LGBTQ adults, although significant disparities in access remained. Even with expanded access to care, LGBTQ adults were still more likely to report having trouble paying medical bills and going without necessary medical care because they could not afford it, researchers wrote. Progress made, more progress to be made. Okay, well, that brings us to our closing segment, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. I have 15 bonus articles this week. First up, what wildfire smoke, gas stoves, and COVID tell us about our air. So it seems like the overarching theme of this show is about air quality. Bonus article 2, how the public health lessons of COVID can help Americans protect themselves from wildfire smoke. So hopefully COVID is kind of be a preface about air quality that can give us some wisdom into how to deal with wildfire smoke. Although one difference is, for instance, with respiratory viruses, you want to bring in outside air, quote, fresh air, in order to dilute and get out the viral particles. But with wildfire smoke, you don't want a lot of air exchanges because then you'd just be bringing in the pollutant into the home. Bonus article 3, the Air Quality Index explained, and what it means and how to stay safe. Another good backgrounder. Hopefully you picked up some of that this week, but good background article. Bonus article 4, how to pick the right air purifier for your home as wildfire smoke descends. So for people like myself who have asthma, picking an air purifier is something that you want to do for your air much of the time. But it looks like more and more of us are going to have to be dealing with that as we have the regularity of smoke and other pollutions descending upon us. Bonus article 5, climate crisis is on track to push one-third of humanity out of its most livable environment. So, of course, the climate crisis is posing a lot of problems, and it looks like in coming decades, on the track that we're going down right now, we could have a full one-third of humanity that's living in what is currently considered unlivable environments. Bonus article 6, fears about the future of the planet will impact all of us. It's how we act on them that matters, says researchers. So, of course, it's stressful thinking about these many huge and existential crises that the planet faces, but also how we respond to them can help mitigate some of the negative effects. And the reality is, problems require effort, and it does cause some mental stress. Another challenge layered upon it all. Bonus article 7, removing antimicrobial resistance from the WHO's pandemic treaty will leave humanity extremely vulnerable. So it looks like, you know, coming off the COVID-19 pandemic, that when they're looking at a pandemic treaty, they're thinking mostly respiratory viruses. But antimicrobial resistance is a growing problem and can be definitely be a leading cause of death in the next 20 or 30 years. A different kind of pandemic, but one that can be foreseen, so we should account for it now in our planning. Bonus Article 8. UK no longer following EU guidelines on cutting safe levels of BPA plastic containers. As a result, the safe level of BPA in plastic containers in the UK is now, wait for it, 20,000 times higher than in Europe. So Europe is tightening down as the research gets better and better, documenting how low doses BPA can be and cause severe health problems. UK, unfortunately, since it left the European Union, is going its own way and is going in reverse. Well, the US, which tends to more resemble the UK, is making some progress, but has a long way to go. But this next bonus article gives us some heart. Bonus Article 9, states take matters into their own hands to ban forever chemicals. So as much change occurs from the bottom up, states are making changes in their state laws, which hopefully will drive changes in the federal laws, and hopefully the world will get it all together, and we can deal with these forever chemicals once and for all. Bonus Article 10. The ways pollution and climate change are linked to policing and incarceration. So this is an interesting article that really ties together the connections and overlaps of different public health problems, pollution and climate change, and policing and incarceration. An article, I guess, about what would, in technical terms, would be called intersectionality. Next up, bonus Article 11 takes us back to 1984 with the Bhopal toxic gas release in India. Industrial disasters may cause higher rates of disability and cancer for future generations. So being decades and decades ago, researchers have been studying. This is what public health people do. We look at things and see what happens. And sure enough, when you actually look at it, these industrial disasters are not just about immediate effects, but there are many long-term effects and can cause higher rates of disability and cancer for generations to come. Bonus Article 12, Health and Human Services' first national sexually transmitted infection plan could face obstacles, just as sexually transmitted infection rates reach record highs. So I've reported on this before, kind of some of the obstacles, particularly with the budget deal, which is making budgetary-wise less flexibility when you have spikes in health problems or growing health problems. It kind of stiffens up the nimbleness that you need to respond to them. And this is one example where the budget deal or deficit deal could be cutting public health successes and interfering with public health problems. Bonus Article 13, U.S. government sets penalties on 43 drugs over price hikes. So they had passed a law saying that drugs could not raise drug prices more than the cost of inflation, and there are 43 drugs that exceeded that, and this is a clawback, basically, where Medicare requires the difference, the amount that's over inflation, to be rebated back to Medicare and even to those patients. So that's good, and of course, Medicare covers a lot of the drug costs in this country. But when you raise those prices, you may get a clawback for Medicare, but you raise those prices for everybody else outside of Medicare. Bonus Article 14, exploring the effect of law enforcement drug market disruptions on overdoses. This is a journal article, so therefore, and actually the longer title is even more complex. But this was a study basically looking when you're doing drug busts. Like we're talking about, you know, law enforcement interdiction efforts to like stop fentanyl, for instance. And how does this affect overdoses? Well, it may seem counterintuitive to people, but when they looked at this, they found that drug busts actually increase overdoses. And this is partly ascribed to the fact that people that are taking drugs often have an established source of those drugs, and they know about those drugs, that kind of thing. You know, they know their drug dealer, you know your local drug dealer. When those things are disrupted, people go through non-normal sources, which actually, apparently, increases the chances that people will get overdoses. Another one is if you can't get access to drugs for a little while, the tolerance that you have can decrease, and then when you take another dose, even if it doesn't have huge amounts, you can actually respond to it differently than if you had taken, if it interrupted your normal course of drug taking. So a little bit counterintuitive, and another example of how drug interdiction isn't necessarily the solution to our drug problems. We have to affect demand and deal with prevention. And lastly, but not least, bonus article 15. Jump in child deaths reveals impact of industrialization on Amazon's indigenous peoples. So I've done various reporting on how indigenous peoples who live very subsistence, what we would call subsistence lifestyles, actually have some very profound health benefits. Low blood pressure, you know, where we see blood pressure rise as a normal thing in industrialized, stressed out societies, actually blood pressure remains the same throughout life and actually decreases slightly in older age in indigenous peoples. But when industrialization comes into their lives, it actually increases health problems. Something to be said for a simpler way of life, more connected to the earth. Well, you can read this and all the other stories I have reported on in this show and even previous shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-